This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
In 1977, the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind was released with the tagline, "We are not alone." Well, you know what? We really aren't, and it has nothing to do with aliens. There are thousands of tiny organisms living in our bodies right now, and we couldn't live without them.
Bacteria and the fungi are really interacting with each other. They're interacting with the human cells.
On today's Health Show, we'll take a look at the human microbiome.
We'll hear reports from the NIH and a national health journalist about the amount of microbes that hitch a ride in our gut. And we'll talk to a microbiome researcher about how understanding how these germs work with our bodies may help us find treatments for conditions from cancer to obesity. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show.
Within the body of a healthy adult, it is estimated that the cells of microbes outnumber human cells by a factor of 10 to 1. These communities of microscopic organisms, however, remain largely unstudied, leaving almost entirely unknown their influence upon human development, physiology, immunity, and nutrition. Joe Belinfi from the National Institutes of Health has more.
Microbes are tiny organisms.
Those are organisms that you typically can only see if you look under a microscope.
Dr. Julia Segre at the National Human Genome Research Institute explains that microbes, which can be bacteria, viruses, fungi, or protozoa, live everywhere.
What's amazing there is that if you sample soil or water, you'll find about 100 different bacterial phylum. Only about 7 or 8 can live in and on the human.
Some microbes cause diseases. Others are essential for a healthy life. Traditionally, scientists have focused on the study of specific kinds of microbes. But now, researchers are taking advantage of recent technological advances to better understand the entire microbiome.
The definition of the microbiome is the DNA of all of the small organisms that live in and on our body.
Dr. Segre explains that scientists now appreciate that a lot of the functions of a human body are actually carried out by these small organisms. Digestion is one example. So research is expanding to investigate not only human DNA, but also the DNA of all the microbes that live on and in us.
We have to think about it with this layer of complexity that the bacteria and the fungi are really interacting with each other. They're interacting with the human cells, and that it is a community of organisms that are together creating this protein encoding potential that could vastly exceed our own human cells.
For more information about the Human Microbiome Project, visit the website nihroadmap.nih.gov/HMP. This is Joe Belinfi, National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
So the bacteria that colonizes our bodies is known as the human microbiome, and the types of bacteria that make up our individual biome go a long way towards making us who we are. In an article in the February 26th issue of the Saturday Evening Post, Sharon Begley, health and science correspondent at Reuters, says we need those germs to survive. I spoke to Sharon about her article and why these microbes are so important for us to survive.
Well, because as your question implies, they have all sorts of beneficial functions. They do outnumber us 10 to 1, but of course they're so small that they actually account for only 1 or 2% of our weight. But we do carry around in us and on us something like 10,000 different species of bacteria, skin, digestive tract, all over, mouth, nose, and the research now has been looking at, well, if we're carrying around all of these little one-celled things, what are they doing there?
We have so much now that goes around to fight germs. There's hand sanitizers everywhere. We're kind of like germ phobic as a society. Is this having unintended consequences?
Well, it does seem to be. researchers have not looked so much at the hand sanitizers, which, as you're saying, Bob, are ubiquitous, but really at the antibiotics that we have been popping like Tic Tacs or something lately. Not only when we browbeat the doctor into giving us a prescription for antibiotics, when in fact what we have is not going to be treated by them, but also, of course, in the food supply. For decades now, farmers have been giving antibiotics to beef cattle and pigs and chickens, and the reason is that antibiotics in the animal feed fattens them up. But of course, now we too are ingesting all of the antibiotics, and the effects are starting to show up.
You mentioned a few specific germs in the article, and one is H. pylori, which we heard about a few years ago as the actual cause for ulcers. And they said, well, good, let's get rid of H. pylori. And now all of a sudden, it might have something to do with a lot of kids getting asthma.
Yeah, this was an interesting one. You know, once upon a time, it was in almost everybody's gut. But lately, it's been found in just 6% of U.S. children. This was a study that came out a couple of years ago. And the reason, scientists surmise, is indeed the widespread use of antibiotics and also antimicrobials. These are often the things that, you know, you swab down your kitchen with and things. And that should mean fewer ulcers, which, of course, is a good thing. But there's also a suggestion that H. pylori wards off asthma. And as you know, we've had an explosion in the incidence of asthma, especially among children, over the last few years. So to investigate that, researchers up here at NYU, New York University, studied children with asthma, and they found that those without H. pylori are more likely to have asthma. And when they looked at adults, the adults were also more likely to have had asthma when they were children. So, you know, you look at that kind of result and you say, well, maybe that's just a coincidence. So whenever that happens, scientists go to the mice, and that's what happened in a lab in Switzerland. There, the researchers infected half of their mice with H. pylori, and they left the other half germ-free. And then they exposed all of the mice, both with and without H. pylori, to dust mites and all the other allergens that often trigger an asthma attack. And they found that the mice with H. pylori were fine, but those without the microbe had the inflammation of the airways that's the the hallmark of asthma. So they don't know how it works, how H. pylori might ward off asthma. Still a lot of research to go on, but certainly the correlation, at least, is, you know, just fascinating.
You report about a lot of research going on now on how to change what's called the microbiome of the human body. We have the genome, which, you know, it's our genes. They're going to be there for life. But the biome, the amount of different and the types of different bacteria could be changed, and that might help fight certain conditions. And one you mentioned is obesity.
Yeah. So when we read the calorie count on a fast food menu or a grocery item or whatever, we think, okay, if it says 800 calories and if I eat the whole thing, I'm going to be ingesting 800 calories. But as is so often the case with obesity, it turns out to be more complicated than that. The calories that you get from a food depend not only on how many calories are in the food, and that's determined by basically, you know, measuring the food's energy content in a lab. It depends on how many of those calories your digestive system extracts from the food. One person's digestive system might extract all 800 calories, and another person's might extract only 700 or 600. The point is that the calorie extraction depends not only on, you know, your own metabolism and your digestive enzymes, but also on the microbes that are in your gut. So if one person has really, really efficient microbes and they extract every single one of those 800 calories, then you are getting more of the calories in your food than somebody whose microbes extract many fewer. And you might think, well, that's, you know, a good thing to extract all the calories possible. And undoubtedly, that was a good thing, you know, centuries ago when food was not as ubiquitous and cheap and fattening as it is now. But these days, of course, if you can extract fewer calories from at least some of your food, you're more likely to be slim. And in fact, when researchers did a comparison of the gut microbes in thin people and obese people, they did find that indeed there were differences.
As you were writing this and researching this, was there anything that just made you stand up and go, really?
Just how many conditions and illnesses seem to be affected by the gut microbes and the other microbes? It ranges from tooth decay, sinusitis, maybe even autoimmune disease, atherosclerosis. And you compare that to, as you were alluding to earlier, Bob, just the carpet bombing that we're doing against microbes, the idea that, all germs are to be eradicated. The only good germ is a dead germ. But again, as with the research on asthma, obesity, some microbes indeed are contributing to our health, and we're eradicating them at our peril.
Sharon Begley is health and science correspondent at Reuters. You can read her article, Why We Need Germs, in the February 26th issue of the Saturday Evening Post. Go to SaturdayEveningPost.com.
Still to come, so what exactly is the Human Biome Project? We'll get an in-depth explanation about this research next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1303.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
We've been talking about the importance of the microbes that live in our bodies, the human microbiome. So how exactly do these germs keep our systems running? Here to give us some in-depth answers and maybe some even more puzzling questions is Dr. James Versalovic, head of the Department of Pathology and director of the Texas Children's Microbiome Center at Texas Children's Hospital in Houston. He co-authored an exploration of the human intestinal microbiome for the April 2013 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry. I asked him to tell us about the Human Microbiome Project.
Well, the Human Microbiome Project is a big science project that was initiated in 2007, a large-scale effort that was spearheaded by the director of the National Institutes of Health and a cross-institutes effort with four genome centers across the United States and many other laboratories involved. So this is really big science, first of all. And it's ushered in a new era in science because we've taken the knowledge of the human genome and advances in human biochemistry to understand not only the human genes, but all of the microbial genes that are part of us. They're part of the human beings. We call it the second genome. And those genes now also encode for proteins, enzymes that affect a variety of metabolic pathways. And the metabolic activity of the microbiome is considered to be as or more complex than the human liver. So you can imagine potential impact of this project and understanding not only the genes, but the enzymes and metabolites and the pathways and how they might be involved in human or mammalian biology. So this has been a major new development, and it's important to remind ourselves it's only been 6 years, and we're now entering really the second phase of the project, which is moving from discovery and large-scale sequencing efforts describing microbial composition in humans and other mammals to trying to understand the functional relevance of this and how we might translate this knowledge to understand mechanisms of disease. And in particular today, disorders of body metabolism, metabolic syndrome, obesity, diabetes, and a number of related conditions.
Doctor, there must be thousands upon thousands of different microbes in our intestines. Which of these and which microbial genes are considered to play major roles in human metabolism?
Well, it's hard to answer that question at this point in time in 2013, but certainly we can say a few things based on the knowledge gathered in the past 6 years. We have approximately 1,000 different bacteria, and that's more than 90% of the content of the microbiome is bacterial. I should mention that there certainly are viruses and yeasts or fungi that are also a small part of this. Roughly about 1,000 different bacterial organisms in the human intestine and a variety of other bacteria that are colonizing different body sites. So it's important to also mention that this human microbiome differs depending on body site, so the intestine versus the skin, the airways, the oral cavity, a variety of body surfaces. The intestine is considered to be really most important at this time in terms of its effects on body metabolism. At this point in the project, we've counted more than 10 million microbial genes compared to 20 to 25,000 human genes. Of the greater than 10 million genes, it's really hard to say which are most critical at this time. What's interesting is of the 1,000 or so microbes in the human intestine, 20 to 25 organisms are considered to be dominant in each intestine. And so if we multiply that by about 2,000 genes per microbe, we're left with a much more manageable set of genes. So we might be considering 50,000 genes, and of those genes, how many are most critical? And certainly some of these rare microbes may be important biologically, so it's not simply about quantity, but also quality. We would estimate now that there are hundreds of genes that would be considered pivotal in human metabolism. And that still puts us in a kind of a vague zone, but nevertheless, that's the ballpark. And we're now trying to understand which specific genes may have specific effects and how those effects impact human health.
How can these gut microbes mediate the effects of high levels of sugar and fat in the human diet?
We're now beginning to draw connections between diet, nutrition, the microbiome, and human health and disease. What's particularly exciting now is that the microbiome appears to be a very important bridge between diet and human health. And as a bridge, it contains so many genes that we've just discussed, and microbes and pathways, metabolites, enzymes that may be pivotal in body metabolism. And there are a number of components in diet to consider. So as we break down diet, we've mentioned sugar and fat. Sugar, of course, is a carbohydrate, but gut bacteria have a number of enzymes now that we know play a role in helping us to digest the sugar or carbohydrates in the diet. We've moved rapidly in the last two decades from a rather simplistic notion of sugar to the fact that we have many different kinds of sugars in the diet, and we're still trying to understand the composition of many foods, frankly. So food chemistry, food science is still important. But within the microbiome, there are a number of enzymes that digest these sugars and make them available to us as nutrients. Much of this activity is going on in the small intestine, but we do think that it's important in both the small and large intestine or colon. The bacteria then help to break down those complex carbohydrates in the diet to simple sugars that can be absorbed, and those sugars and oligosaccharides then may have a direct impact on blood glucose levels, for example, and the kinds of metabolites then that make their way to the liver. Another aspect of this is early in life. Gut bacteria have the ability to metabolize the carbohydrates in breast milk. So as babies get human milk, they are, in a sense, feeding their microbiome, but then providing the substrate, the sugar, if you will, for the bacteria, the gut microbes, to then break down these sugars and stimulate gut development. That's very an interesting connection that a few scientists have uncovered in recent years. And in this way, then, bacteria can provide signals. And we're not exactly clear on the nature of these signals, but they're basically carbohydrate metabolism byproducts that may impact the ability of the epithelial lining of the intestine to mature, differentiate, and form a healthy intestine. In terms of fat, there are a number of enzymes that are involved in metabolizing fat in the diet. And we know that some of this fat is essential for life. And the gut microbes can break down fat into short-chain fatty acids, things like acetate and butyrate. So these are some examples of how gut microbes can effectively help us metabolize our diet. But what's really interesting is that the microbes, in a sense, are translating. They're converting these dietary sugars and fats and proteins also into small molecules, metabolites, that then can be utilized by human cells. And then this affects the biology of the intestine, the ability to digest and absorb nutrients, the whole body metabolism, and additionally the functioning of the immune system and the nervous system. So many different effects that go beyond effects on body metabolism.
Well, finally, Doctor, let's look ahead. What's next for your work and the Human Microbiome Project?
We are now at the point where we want to deeply understand how the microbiome makes the signals that may impact body metabolism. That's what we refer to de novo biosynthesis, basically starting from scratch, can bacteria take a variety of chemicals? And we're really thinking now about human biochemistry and making signals, serving as microbial factories, if you will. The other part of this, and we're still are trying to understand which enzymes may be pivotal and which signals may be made de novo. In addition to that, though, and even more importantly, we think that luminal conversion, or the ability to convert these specific components of the human diet into signals that then affect metabolism, for example, sugar metabolism, fat metabolism, protein metabolism, and the immune system and inflammation, we're trying to focus on which components of the diet are converted into these signals. And that's luminal conversion. The lumen refers to the intestine itself, the cavity, if you will, where the microbes, including the bacteria, reside. And it's the conversion of the diet that we're ingesting. We're eating every day. We're drinking every day. And that food is then making its way down into the intestine. And so it's basically flooding the microbiome, literally, with food compounds, and a variety of different sugars, proteins, and lipids. And those are being converted by a number of different metabolic pathways of the microbiome. We're really trying to focus on the functional aspect of this problem now, to try and understand how the microbiome is functioning, and then how is that directly impacting body metabolism. And that is really a major emphasis now. In addition to that, we're really going to be focusing now on translating these discoveries of microbial composition and function of the human microbiome to new diagnostic tests. In other words, we will be using these metabolic pathways to find new biomarkers. And similar to how we use blood tests to look, for example, for prostate-specific antigen, or PSA, for individuals who may be at risk for prostate cancer, or we may look at blood cholesterol levels, we may look at C-reactive protein to follow patients with inflammation. We also now are thinking about microbial biomarkers. Are there biomarkers that come from these microbes that provide signals to us that something is wrong? And can we use those in a variety of tests in the hospital or in the clinical laboratory to be able to say that this patient may be predisposed to diabetes or metabolic syndrome or a variety of other conditions, even susceptibility to cancer? We are also thinking about these genes and how the DNA, RNA may be used from the microbiome to develop new diagnostic tests and to enable us to take a disease in which we may be lumping many patients together to begin to stratify or separate these conditions so that we can provide a better match between the patient and the right treatment, to enable us to have more personalized or customized medicine by combining the knowledge of the microbiome and the human genome. And that's where we're headed. And in addition to that, finally, we want to develop treatments. Of course, it's not just about diagnosing, but can we use the knowledge of the human microbiome to supplement these microbial deficiencies by adding bacteria into the diet, such as probiotics, to change the diet and provide the right mix of sugars and proteins and lipids and other compounds, such as prebiotics, but even more general dietary changes or modifications. This may really impact the field of dietetics and human nutrition. And then finally, do we need to do things that are more drastic? In other words, really think about cutting back on antibiotic use that may impact the function of the microbiome, may predispose us to disease, or should we be replacing microbiomes such as fecal transplantation or intestinal microbiome transplantation in very severe cases in which the microbiome is involved? So there are a number of therapies now that may affect, hopefully positively impact, patients that currently have metabolic syndrome, diabetes, and a number of different conditions.
Dr. James Versalovic is the head of the Department of Pathology and director of the Texas Children's Microbiome Center at Texas Children's Hospital in Houston. You can read more about the human microbiome in the April 2013 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry. That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.